Hello, everyone, and welcome to another edition of Putting and the Gutter. This is my podcast. I'm your host, Joe Ambrose, PGA golf professional, PBA bowling professional. And those are the subjects that we focus on, but of course, we always do other stuff. And today we have a few things that we'll talk about. And we're going to start with this weekend, which is one of the best tournaments of the year on the PGA Tour, the Players' Championship. I decided to discuss this because this is the 50th anniversary of the Players. And I couldn't find another tournament like this that for 50 years, there's been repeat winners, but there's never been a back-to-back champion. I thought that was kind of ironic and says an awful lot about the field that goes to this tournament and also about the golf course that it's played on, TPC Sawgrass, which is located in Florida and designed, as we all know, by Pete Dye. This event started in 1974 and was the brainchild, really, of Joe Dye, who was the PGA president at the time. And the Players, and Dean Beaman had a lot to do with it. He was a tour commissioner. The Players wanted to have an event that was just for them. We already had the four majors, but there was obviously some differences on qualifying. USJ as their way of doing it. The Masters is more of an invitational. The Open Championship from England, not everybody wanted to go to because it was worldwide, but they wanted to have something just for the Players, basically as a season-ending event. So this is what they came up with. The event started at the Atlanta Country Club in 1974, and I think as luck would have it, Jack Nicklaus won the first one and went on to win two more. But like I said before, there's never been a repeat champion. And the list of people that have won this thing, yeah, there's been some one-hit wonders, I guess, for lack of a better term. But the list of people that have won, listen to these players, and they're either Hall of Famers or have won majors before. So I'll start with Jack Nicklaus, who won the first one and has won three times. Then this is incredible. Then next is Lee Trevino, Lanny Watkins, Ray Floyd, Jerry Pate, who won the U.S. Open in 76, Hal Sutton, who won it twice, Fred Couples, who won it twice, John Mahaffey, who won a PGA, Sandy Lyle won the Masters and had another major as well, Tom Kite, Steve Elkington won twice, Davis Love III won twice, Nick Price, Greg Norman, who actually has the tournament record aggregate scoring in 1994 and is still held up 30 years later, which is pretty incredible considering technology and equipment and all the stuff that's available now. Lee Jansen, Justin Leonard, David Duvall, Tiger Woods, as good as Tiger is, he's only won this tournament twice. It's not an easy golf course, as we all know. Adam Scott, Phil Mickelson, Sergio Garcia, Henrik Stenson, Martin Keimer, who has two majors, Jason Day, Webb Simpson, Justin Thomas, Rory McIlroy, who's only won once, and defending champion Scottie Scheffler. That is one heck of a list of people and shows you how demanding that this golf course is. It's not super long. It's definitely not the longest event that they play on the tour, not by a long shot. But with the amount of water and trouble lurking on each hole, it is definitely a shot maker's golf course. We've seen big hitters win here. We've seen medium hitters win here. But really, you need to be on with your second shots. You need to hit fairways. And your short game needs to be amazing. So by listening to that list of champions, all those guys have, you know, some part of that. I feel that the last three holes, 16, 17, 18, I've watched a lot of golf in my life, and I know you all have too. I've never seen three holes that can cause, you could birdie all three of them, or you could make three doubles in a heartbeat. Number 16 is a par five with water all the way up the right side, but it's reachable. It's in the 500-yard range, which is not much for tour pros, and they're hitting driver and probably a mid-iron into the green. But they have to be very precise if they want to have an eagle opportunity, and you can't miss right or the ball's obviously in the water. 17 is probably, other than number 12 at Augusta, it's probably the most famous par three on the planet. It's not a long hole. From the back tees, it might be 135, 140, I think, is as far as they can stretch it out to. But you never know what the wind's going to be like there. It's an island green. It's completely surrounded by water. And how many times have we seen, you know, somebody make a birdie when they really needed to, or somebody blow a lead when they had one coming into 17, because there's really no place to bail out. It's either you hit the green or the front bunker or the little bit of area that's right around it, or that's it. But it's an awesome hole. It really is. And then 18 is a brutal par four with water all the way up the left side that you have to play safe. You have to bail out right. And if you do that, then you got a really long shot in for your second shot with, again, water on the left all the way up. And if you need a par on the last hole to win, it's a tough hole to make a par on, but it's just great theater. It's a stadium course, so the fans have good vantage points to see everything, and I always look forward to it every year. And the way the tour schedule is now, with that tournament basically coming before the majors, it's almost, this is going to be a great setup for Augusta in a couple weeks. So I'll be watching this weekend, and I can't wait to see how everybody does and who actually wins. My next subject for this podcast is something that I did for 17 years as an NCAA coach, and that's college bowling. The reason I picked it this week is because we're getting close to the end of the bowling season. Bowling season actually starts in college, and October 1 is the first day you can play. And conference championships in the NCAA aren't until this year, March 23rd to 25th, so in a few weeks. But this month is big because I think it's the only sport, and I could be wrong, you can email me at joeambrose@pga.com if I am wrong, but I think it's the only sport that combines not only Division 1, 2, 3 on the NCAA side for women's bowling, but USBC, which is the United States Bowling Congress, they have, since the 1970s, they have club bowling for men and for women. There is no men's bowling in NCAA because NCAA created women's bowling as a Title IX sport in 2003-04. So we're basically on the 20th anniversary of that this season. But this past weekend, at four sites across the country, there was something called ITC Sectionals, which is basically USBC's qualifier to get to nationals. So how this works is any team can go, either club teams or NCAA teams can go to tournaments during the season, and there's a point system. So based on how you finish compared to other teams in the field, you get points, and the USBC selects 64 teams to represent or gets invited to sectionals at four different sites across the country. This year they happen to be in Michigan, Texas, Illinois, and Tennessee. That's varied over the years. When I was at Kutztown, we used to play when it was in Allentown because it made sense, because it was only 30 minutes from our campus and we didn't have to do any hotel rooms. So that's how we actually got involved with it. 2010-11 was the first time that we did it, And we were fortunate enough. We had good players, and we made it to Nationals 4 years in a row, which is something I was very proud of as a coach. But the format for sectionals is very, very, very unique. I've never seen anything like it in any other sport. I know you all know what a regular bowling game is for 10 frames when you're doing it by yourself or in a league or with your friends. But college bowling is unique because we have something called the Baker system. Now, let me try to explain the Baker system without confusing anybody. You're allowed 8 players at sectionals and most events now to travel with you to an event. So you have a starting 5, and they'd be in position, you know, 1st, 2nd, 3rd, 4th, 5th. Well, when you're bowling a Baker game with 5 players, each player throws 2 frames out of 10 to make up 1 game. So you would have a leadoff player, then 2nd, then 3rd, then 4th, and then 5th, which we would call your anchor player. Those players would repeat the process 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. So each player would throw 2 frames. Now, a coach can make a substitution at any time that game with anybody that's on his bench or her bench. And so I've done this at both schools. I did it at KU because I had enough players. But you can actually have a Baker game with 10 different players if you want to. Now you can't because the rosters are limited to 8. But you can still sub those other 3 in to make up your game. Most 95% of the time, you're going to pick your 5, your order, and those 5 are going to throw 2 frames each, and that's your game total. And then you would either keep the lineup the same or adjust it, maybe change the order, you know, from game to game. But sectionals are unique because you actually bowl 64 Baker games over 2 days on a Saturday and Sunday. And you bowl 32 games one day, 32 games the next day. And out of the 16 teams at each sectional, the top 4 get to go to Nationals, which is in April. So it's based 100% on total pinfall. And the reason this is different than what I'm used to as an NCAA coach is because NCAA is based on match play. If my team was playing, say, Nebraska, Vanderbilt, or one of the other schools, we play on a pair of lanes, you know, that are together, like lanes 5 and 6 or 9 and 10, et cetera. And whoever would have the highest pin total of that game would get a win. And that's how the NCAA would make their selections for nationals, is based on win-loss, based on RPI, and based on strength of schedule across the season. Before the days of automatic qualifiers that are there now for NCAA bowling, pre-2016-17 might have been the first year that we had nationals the way they are now, with a lot of teams, more teams being able to qualify. And if you win your conference, you get an automatic bid. That wasn't the case in the early years of NCAA bowling. So there was a lot of teams that did win their conference that never really, I mean, it was great that they won, but they never got to go to nationals because of it. So now the teams that just bowled sectionals this past weekend in the 4 sites that I mentioned, there are 16 teams that are going to get to go to nationals. Now, it doesn't matter how they did during the regular season. Maybe they just bowled a lot of events and they got allowed to go. Maybe they bowled really well in a lot of events and that's how they qualified. There's all kinds of different ways to qualify. But I think it's really cool that all college teams get to attend this if they wish. Some schools don't, because they don't want to spend the money on non-NCAA events. And I totally get that. But I'll tell you from experience, this is an incredible opportunity of value for your players and your student athletes. This is a bonding thing like I've never seen before. When you bowl that many games together and you spend that much time on a weekend and there's that much at stake, it's just a really neat thing. And the last time that one of my teams got to nationals, we actually made it by one pin. So imagine bowling all those games and adding up all the numbers for all those games, and you make it into nationals by one pin. That was probably one of the most incredible things as a coach I ever went through. And it's like nothing you've ever seen. It's a long, long weekend. And some one of these years, if you've never seen it, you should try to go to one of the sites and watch, because it's really, really neat and really neat to see. So I hope you all get a chance to do it. But I just wanted to give a shout out to all the teams that did qualify. If you want to look up who did, just go to bowl.com, look up ITC sectionals, and you can see results. And you can see how teams did at each site and who made it, who didn't make it, etc. For NCAA, it's going to be different. The conference championships are in 2 weeks, March 23rd to 25th, and then there will be AQs, automatic qualifiers for them, similar to what we have for basketball. And the rest of the teams will be picked at large. So now NCAA, the way they do it is there's actually 16 teams that will go at nationals. They'll have four regionals of four teams each. The national committee will select who goes where, and then one team out of each four will go to the national site and play in the final four, and that's how it's done. I could get into some more deals on how the format is for NCAA, how much different it is than college bowling in general, on the club level, but I'll save that discussion maybe after nationals and try to explain how we're doing things. The other good thing about college bowling is, because USBC does it this way and allows every team to compete, all women's teams across the country can compete. And for men, this is it. Like, this is their national or their regionals and their nationals, because NCAA bowling, there is no men's bowling. It never has been. And there may never will be, because, like I had said before, and women's bowling was created because of Title IX. So the men have more teams at these things than the women do, because this is really, some schools save their money and make sure that they go just to give their players the experience. And it's bowling Baker like that. You should try it sometime with your friends, and you'll see how difficult it is to get five people to actually do something like this at the same time. And it's just crazy. Just try it sometime and then email me and let me know how it went. It's really cool. Okay. My last thing I want to cover, and I may do a separate podcast in the next couple of days, because I'm a big basketball fan, and we all know March Madness is coming up, which is an incredible tournament. We all love watching the games for, whatever reason, whether it's schools we like or whatever, but that tournament has just got it over every other college sport, because it's just so cool to watch. But I would be remiss if I didn't mention the most popular person in our country right now on women's basketball, and that's Caitlin Clark, who attends University of Iowa. I've never seen in all my years any woman that's had the impact on women's basketball that she has. And that's saying something, considering how good Tennessee was years ago, all the championships that UConn women's basketball has won, how South Carolina has built their program into what it is. And now here's school in Iowa with this girl who grew up in Des Moines and goes to her home school, her home college. And they obviously have other players too, because they're ranked in the top five in the country. But she has lifted women's basketball to another level. And I know we're all really, really excited to see what she can do in the WNBA. I know I am. So I'll be watching for sure. Just a couple things on her. Just the reason why I think her contribution to women's basketball is so significant and women's sports in general. Okay, she just broke the scoring record for women's basketball all time. That's obviously amazing. There's been a lot of people who scored a lot of points and their teams really didn't follow them because maybe they didn't have the players around them or for some other reason. But what Caitlin's actually able to do is to lift her team up and make them a nationally ranked top five team because she's there. Just in the 23-24 season, she's averaging 31.9 points a game. She's first. The thing that makes that stat cool is she averages 8.9 assists per game. That's first. She's leading the country in both scoring and assists, and she's a rebounder, and she plays defense. It's just really cool to watch. So I hope you'll, if you haven't seen her, I don't know where you've been, but I hope you'll see her in the next couple of weeks because we're not going to see much like that, I don't think, in NCAA women's basketball over the next several years. Her team, Iowa, has won their conference championship 3 years in a row. Last year, they lost in the NCAA final to LSU after knocking off number one South Carolina to get there. And like I said, the women's basketball rankings have never been higher, which is amazing when you consider all the women have come before, Cheryl Swoops and Cheryl Miller and Lisa Leslie and Rebecca Lobo and Brianna Stewart and Diana Taurasi and Sue Bird, and I could go on and on. And it'll just be great. She's declared for the WNBA draft. She's going to be the number one pick. And unless something changes, she's going to be playing in Indiana for the Indiana Fever. And I know I can't really wait to see what she can do there and if she can bring the same level of basketball to the WNBA. It's going to be really cool. Okay, well, I got a lot in a short time, and I hope you enjoyed it. Any questions or comments, of course, joeambrose@pga.com. I would love to hear from everybody. I thank you so much for listening and supporting what I'm doing here. And we'll be back shortly with another edition of Putting and the Gutter. Thank you for listening. See ya. Bye.